Please direct your attention with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. As we look at that one just in review again and then move on, understand there are no chapter breaks. Originally, these were added by somebody, so the transition is pretty much from one right into the other. But we have had a great time the last few weeks looking back at chapter 15, verses 1 to 11, seeing the triumphant statement that Christ arose. And we saw how important, in fact, you know, it really would be better for us to put it this way, Christ was raised. It's more difficult to say, but it is the issue of the passage. Not that Christ rose from the dead, but Christ was raised from the dead. Very clearly stated over and over again, how say some among you that Christ, okay, that the dead are not raised? The issue is that God raised Christ. God will raise us. So that ultimately we saw that God will be all in all. Why? Because he is the one who is the initiator of all of this. So first of all, verses 1 to 11, Christ was raised from the dead. Now, that is so crucial to the gospel message. Without that, there is no gospel message. But what became so clear to us as we went from chapter 15, 1 to 11 into chapter 15, 12 to 20, actually 34, is that it is crucial not only that we believe that Christ was raised, but we understand that we shall be raised. Absolutely crucial, first of all, to the gospel message, verses 12 to 19. Because if there is no resurrection for us, there was no resurrection for him. And if there is no resurrection for him, there is no gospel. So crucial to the gospel message is not just that Christ rose from the dead, but that we too also shall be raised. Also important as we look at that, not only important to the gospel in verses 12 to 19, but important to God himself. The issue in the latter part of that in verse 28, the last part of verse 28, it said, well, let's read all verse 28. When all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself also will be subjected to the one who subjected all things to him, that God may be all in all. It is not, you see, it is not only that Jesus is going to conquer all of these things, but that Jesus is going to submit himself to God when he's conquered everything. And the final thing that has to be conquered is death. And God will not fully be recognized as all and in all until finally death has been conquered. And that cannot happen till you and I rise from the dead. And I trust even as you think about the incredible relationship that Christ has eternally with the Father, when we have been raised from the dead, that's the final thing. He has done all that he came to do. And until we rise again, it's not going to happen. But then when he does that, he will, from that point on, the moment you and I rise from the dead, God, Christ will then eternally submit himself to the Father. And the Father then will be all and in all. An incredible statement. So important to God himself that you and I rise from the dead. But important to godly living, and we'll come back to that in a while in verses 29 to 34, that you and I understand how important our resurrection is to even our godly living. But last week, we went to in verses 35 and following, talking about this how that business. See, they didn't understand how God was going to give people new bodies, so therefore they didn't believe that God was going to give new bodies. And the incredible principle for us to learn last week is we may not understand how, but we do know that. There are a lot of those how that issues for us, aren't there, right? A lot of how that issues. See, we were studying Sunday school this morning. I don't know how in the world he made those few loaves and fish into enough to feed 5,000 and then plus, right? Just 5,000 men plus. So it could have been 20,000 people fed that day with just a few loaves and fish. I don't know how he did it, but I know what. I know that he did, huh? So the how isn't something that we might be able to answer, but the that is something we can say with assurance. And so if we looked last week, I don't know how in the world he's going to take what is of this body, or how he's going to take people whose body have been decomposed, and how he's going to make a new body. I don't even care how. I just know that. I do know one thing, though, that as we looked at last week, there is a connection between this body and that body, but that body may be nothing like this body. I've been reading through Ezekiel, right? And I read about these beings, and I think to myself, there are some weird kind of beings. I mean, they seem weird to me because I look at it just from my point of view. And can you imagine? We don't know what that new body is going to be like, huh? And it's good we don't know, because we couldn't comprehend it anyhow. I don't know how he's going to do it, but I know that he's going to do it. Now, it is interesting because Paul cannot bring us to understand the future without somehow causing us to understand the impact on the present. It is one of the major, major concerns that the Bible has. It's one of the major concerns that I have. It's one of the major concerns you ought to have. What is the relationship of our future hope to our present life? Okay? Peter says, seeing then that all these things are going to happen, what manner of people ought you to be in all holy conversation and godliness? I've been involved in prophetic conferences over the years, and one of the things I think that caused prophecy to sort of die out, It shouldn't die out in our thinking, is because so many times all people want to know what the exotic things about the future. Who's going to do what? When are they going to do it? How are they going to do it? But you know what? You cannot find a prophetic passage anywhere, be it Old Testament or New Testament. And if you find it, please come share it with me. I've never seen it. Where there is not somehow some statement made to those people to whom the prophetic truth is being communicated as to how they're supposed to live. God doesn't just give us prophecy to give us prophecy. He doesn't just tell us about the future so we'll know about the future. When he tells us about the future, he says, because of what's going to happen in the future, this is what we ought to do here today. And almost the statement is, if in fact this isn't how we're living, we really don't have this hope within us. He that hath this hope within himself, what? In 1 John, purifies himself. So as we look at chapter 15, you cannot miss the impact. In verse 29, he says, otherwise, of chapter 15, what will those who are baptized, what will those do who are baptized? The dead, if the dead are not raised at all, why then are they baptized for them? Now, we looked at this and we said it's a difficult passage, but it really has to do with commitment. These people who had seen a beloved brother or sister die in the Lord and says, you know, I want to stand in their place. And the baptism is in the place of, actually. It's a very interesting word. It's the preposition, same preposition used for substitutionary atonement on our part. It isn't as if somehow you can save somebody else by being baptized, but in the sense that I want to stand in their place, I want to make a statement of commitment. And he's saying, why make this commitment at all, if in fact there is no resurrection of the dead? Then he goes in the verses that follow and says, you know, I've got another problem. Why endanger your life if there is no resurrection of the dead? Why, verse 30, why are we also in danger every hour? See, I have a problem with this, he says. Why in the world should I endanger myself and put myself in a place where in fact I might die if in fact the dead are not going to rise again? Why in the world do it? He says, it ought to change my willingness to give myself up. And, you know, in this day and age when so many of us, so much of our prayer request is praying somehow that God will restore our physical bodies to us as if we're clinging to this life. If I understand there's a new body, and if I understand it outdoes this one, if I understand it's going to last forever, if I understand this is only a temporary thing and I'm only here for a while, if I understand all of that, why in the world do I want to stay here? I mean, does it make any sense? I mean, we've lost something, okay, in the process. We all have, because of our earthboundedness. And somebody walking out last week says, you know, the problem. You see somebody who has a lot of physical problems. They're anxious to get there because they want God to sort of straighten it all out, right? Those of us who are healthy somehow, we're just satisfied to stay around here. I go back to Philippians. See, I want to know him. I want to be like him. And I want to what? I want to be with him. And you know, so many times when we cry out to God, we cry out to God because we say, God, oh, come, you know, quickly come. Why? Because we just want to get out of this mess. That's why we want him to come. How about forgetting getting out of this mess? I just want to go there because I want to be with him. I want to be like him. And I cannot be fully like him until I'm in his presence and see him as he really is. So anyhow, he says it changes all of that. Then he says the other thing, it certainly changes the way I live. And he talks about this in verse 32, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. I mean, why in the world not do that, you see, if in fact there is no resurrection? And so certainly it changes my level of commitment. It certainly changes my willingness to endanger myself for the cause of Christ. Not just to go out and endanger myself, to endanger myself, but certainly a reckless abandon to God. And then certainly it changes the level of purity of my life. It ought to. It ought to. John says that as well. It changes my commitment and endurance in chapter 15 of verse 58. Therefore, because of all of these things, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, because you know that your toil, your labor is not in vain in the Lord. If I really believe all of these things to be true, I should be a different kind of person. We're coming close to the end of this book. You know, my mother came here and she heard this word eschatological that everybody's using. And she says, tell me about this, see? Do you understand? I mean, I don't understand, but I'm starting to understand, right? Do you understand a bit more the eschatological nature of life? Do you understand that it's about there, not here? Do you understand that somehow what happens there transforms what I am here if I really believe it? And somehow my earthboundedness needs to be let go of more and more, right? Stop, Peter says, fashioning yourself according to your former lusts and your ignorance. I didn't know better before. And I didn't know better before we started 1 Corinthians. And I've been here before, but I tell you, my life has been so radically changed this last year and a half. It has been. I am not the same person. I just am not. Do you understand the radical eschatological nature of the message that we read? So as we come to chapter 16, see, and there's some tidbits of things he wants to say, the danger is you might separate them from all of this. And I hope you do not, because what happens, Paul started in chapter 7, verse 1, talking about a letter they'd written and talking about a response. And every time he introduces a response, he does it with these words, now concerning. He did it now concerning spiritual gifts and so forth. So here in chapter 16, verse 1, he has a now concerning. And then if you go down with me to verse 12, now concerning or but concerning. You see, these are the last two issues, the fifth and the sixth issue he wants to address that they've addressed in the letter. And my fear is, as we walk through here and read these verses, you just read them and pass on and say, oh, that's nice. I hope you don't just say that. Go with me to verse 12, because I want to show you the impact that this ought to have on our lives. First of all, as giving to us, if in fact I really believe in that future hope that is mine, if I believe in the eschatological nature of life, if I really believe that one day we shall rise again, if I really believe in that and it's going to impact my life, it's going to impact me, first of all, from the context of being a true man of God. And I see this in chapter 16, verse 12. Concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren. And it was not at all his desire to come now, but he will come when his opportunity. And you'll read that and walk on and say, isn't that nice? My friend, this is the whole message of this book. It started in chapter 1, Apollos and Paul. Did it not? Understand the man of God. That this is a message for me. And if you can get something out of it, blessings. But, it started out in chapter 1. You go with me back there, because this whole book is about these two men. And in reality, it started out in chapter 1 where, in fact, there was a division in the church at Corinth to which he's writing. This is a church he planted. And Apollos came in after him. And Apollos was a much better preacher. He was a great orator from Alexandria. And a man could flat out preach. And Paul says himself that his preaching wasn't with great persuasive words, but Apollos sure had some. When you come to chapter 1, it says in verse 12, and I mean this, each one of you is saying, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. The division in this body really came not because of Cephas, not because of Christ, it came because of Apollos. And it wasn't Apollos' fault, okay? It wasn't Apollos who caused it. He was a preacher, happened to come to town, began ministry here. And as he's doing ministry here, people liked his preaching. They began comparing him with the Apostle Paul, and they did not understand the relationship the two of them had. And so therefore, some of them says, I'm of Apollos. Some of them says, I'm of Paul. Somebody says, oh, okay, well, if you're going to do that, I'm of the head of the church himself. I'm of Peter. And then somebody says, well, I'm of Christ. See, as if it's a real pious thing, see. But you know what? The center of all the controversy was this Apollos. You go to chapter 3. And Paul understands the relationship they had with each other. And it's interesting. I mean, I got to tell you this. Apollos and Paul were all right with each other. They had to be. Because Paul doesn't mind bringing Apollos into it as an illustration. Because he understands Apollos understood and he understood and they were good friends. And so notice what happens in verse 4 of chapter 3. Says someone says, I'm of Paul. Another says, I'm of Apollos. Are you not mere men? What then is Apollos? Not who, but what? Not who is Paul, but what is Paul? We are nothing but servants through whom you believed. Okay, you know, lighten up a little bit, you see. And notice, even as that, you see, we are servants of God. Even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one of us, it wasn't as if it was something we did or something he did. And therefore, verse 6, I planted, Apollos watered, but it was God who was causing the growth. You see, we're just instruments. When he comes to chapter 4, he makes that incredible statement in verse 6. These things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you might become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. You see what happens? He says, I don't want to use you as an illustration because you may get offended. Okay, so I'm going to use Paul and I'm going to use Apollos and myself because Apollos won't care and I don't care, and that's all right. See, so let us use us as an example. So from the very beginning, it's these two guys. Now, the last thing, if you were the one, now, see, if this is Paul's church, and it's not Paul's church, see, all the way through the book, right, is the church of God, is the garden of God, is the building of God, is the temple of God, and we need to, all of us, get away from this. You're going to see this before we're through today. It isn't about our church, okay? Please, okay? I know we use that when we say our church, and we, it isn't, you say, well, it's not so bad, but it is bad. It is God's church. If it is Paul's church, if it's something he wants to control, the last person he's going to invite to come back is Apollos. He doesn't need that kind of trouble. There's already trouble here. We don't need to add to it, okay? Well, look at what he says in chapter 16. Look at when he gets there and he says, you know what? I greatly encouraged him to come to you. I begged the man to come back. You say, Paul, are you in your right mind? What's going to happen? You're going to divide this church. All they need is someone else to come back here and start this business. And you know how popular the man was. Do you know, it is interesting in ministry, by the way, watching us. It isn't new, okay? It's as old as the Bible. Paul started the church at Galatia, and what happened? The new guys came. And you know when the new guys came, the problem with it is, I think of the first church I pastored in Sunland. On Latuna Canyon, there is a building. And it isn't that big a church, but there was a guy who pastored the church, came from Guelph. All right, up in Ontario, Canada. And he is in this church, and boy, he built that thing up so fast. He got buses in there, and they built this thing. And they built a new building. He left, and within 6 months, they moved back to the old building because they couldn't fill it without him there. I mean, it isn't that big a building, but it was big to them. So when I started this church, all I hear from one of the guys in the church, because this guy had pastored in Guelph, and one of the members of the church was a kid up in that church in Guelph, and all I heard about was this pastor forever. The first church I'm in, Chip Chase this, and Chip Chase that, and Chip Chase the other thing, and look how big a church Chip Chase is building, see? You know, pretty soon you can get yourself in a motor saying, you know what, who is this Chip Chase guy, right? And so, you know, it was interesting because one day then I invite him to come speak at the church, see? One of the things you've got to be careful of, because Paul had this problem, you know, he'd leave somewhere and somebody else would come in and they'd be saying, Paul this, Paul this, Paul this, Paul this. And pretty soon they start to run Paul down so they can build themselves up. Happened invariably. Happened at Galatia, happened at Thessalonica, happened at Corinth. We become so incredibly possessive, right? And then we become possessive, we become incredibly jealous. And why destroy the church at Galatia? Paul says, you would have plucked your eyes out from me, you received me as Christ himself. Why did you turn? Just because some people said some stuff, you believe it? I can't believe you, he says. I don't understand this. It's this amazing thing that happens. So easy to tear somebody down to build yourself up. And I trust none of us gets into this stuff because, see, it's not ours to begin with, is it? See? So Paul says, I encourage this guy to come back because it's not my church anyhow. See, it's all right. And if these people want to do this, it's all right. We don't want to limit it. But notice what happens. When he invites Apollos to come back, notice what happens. He says, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren, and it was not at all his desire to come. You know, it's interesting because the question is it God's will or his will? Because it's not clear, but the context seems it was not the will to come now. And I think it's Apollos' will. Apollos says, you know what? It's not good for me to go. You see, now he could have come, but see, both of these men are smart men. One of them says, you know what, it's not my church. I'm glad to have this guy come. The other guy says, I'm not about to come because if I come, it will divide a body that's already divided, and they don't need that. It's interesting as it goes on the latter part of the verse. It says, but he will come when he has opportunity. The question isn't whether he has opportunity. He will come when there is the right time. The question is from Apollos' point of view or the Corinthian point of view, and I would think, although it's not clear in the context which it is, I would think it's the Corinthian point of view. Apollos says, there will be a right time for me to come back and preach there, but it's certainly not now. And both of these men were big enough to realize, you see, this is not our church. It is not yours. It's not mine. It's his. Huh? And we're not competing for anything. I trust that we never compete for anything in this business. It's not what we're about. And the minute you see, you know, Apollos wants his, Paul wants his, no, it's not about that, it's God's church. You know, Apollos is free to come back anytime he wants to, and Paul says, but I'm not going to come back. Both of these men were unbelievable because they began to realize that the church was bigger than they were. Do you understand? This church is bigger than you are, it's bigger than I am, it will always be. I mean, it's hard for us even to fathom what God is doing out of this body beyond anything that any of us could have ever anticipated. My friend, if you don't see that this church is far bigger than any of us, in only this short a time that God would be doing what he's doing and opening doors for us to have such an impact around the world in such a dynamic way as I have never in my life seen and you have never in your life seen. This church is not about you. This church is not about me. This church is all about him. And so we stop and say, you know what? The incredible lesson about the man of God. Secondly, go back with me, if you will. And I'm going in reverse on purpose here because I want to bring the last one to about the giving because I want you to see something. I'm going to talk about giving last on purpose because I think it will transform a lot of what you've ever thought about this passage because preachers have used verses 1 to 4 in such an abominable way. And we're not going to do that today, but let's do it. Verses 5 to 11. Look with me at this passage. Guidelines for the church of God. First of all, guidelines for the man of God we saw in verse 12. They must understand the church is not about you. The church is not about me. The church is about God. The church is about what he wishes to do, and we need to get rid of this pettiness that will keep us from being able to minister in a meaningful way. Okay, but notice this next part, the guidelines for the church of God. First of all, look with me at the situation about Paul in verses 8 and 9. I shall remain in Ephesus until Pentecost. Paul has been in Ephesus for some time now and having a very effective ministry there. In fact, he says it in verse 9, a wide door for effective service is open to me. You know, it's interesting because Ephesus was a great place. And I just, by the way, just pause for a while because I'm going to come back to that and talk about it a while. You know, how did he start the church at Ephesus, by the way? Anybody can tell me where he was meeting for a while at Ephesus? Anybody? Where did he meet? He met in a school, did he not? Huh? He met in a school of Tyrannus, actually, is what it was. But it's very interesting because if Paul's ministry at Ephesus came over a long period of time, and he says, you know, what happens is I'm going to be here for a while. And by the way, he chose Pentecost. A Jewish term, by the way, is very interesting. You should choose that writing to Gentile people. And we're going to talk about that in a while. This is the very Jewish nature of this book. If you go back with me, by the way, to verse 2. On the first day of every week, you know what that literally says? According to the first from the Sabbath. It's another Jewish term. See, it's the first day away from the Sabbath, okay? So here, anyhow, he says Pentecost. I want to stay here because God's given me an effective ministry. And there are two reasons why I want to stay here. Number one, because a wide open door for the gospel. And number two, because what? Look at the latter part of this. Why should you want to stay for that? There are many adversaries. You could almost describe Paul's whole ministry this way. Everywhere he went, there was a wide open door for the gospel, and there were many adversaries. It doesn't matter where you go, right? Just think about that for a while. Put something here. Go back with me to your right. A few books to Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians, okay? This seems to be, if you want to put a summary over Paul's life, is this. A wide open door for the gospel, many adversaries. Colossians chapter 1, he makes this statement. He says, I rejoice in my suffering, verse 24. Colossians 1, 24. I rejoice in my suffering for your sake. I rejoice in it, see? I'm suffering for your sake, and I rejoice in it. And in my flesh, I do my share on behalf of the body, which is the church, see? His body, by the way. Notice again, it's his church. We've got his church, his garden, his building, his temple, now his body. So I do my part in behalf of his body in filling up. I love to see the term. It's going to be used again in verse 25. Filling up what is lacking in the suffering of Christ, or the afflictions of Christ. Verse 25, of this church, of this same church, this same body, I was made a minister according to the stewardship from God bestowed on me for your benefit, that I might fully carry out. That word fully carry out is the same term used up before, that I might fill up the preaching of the word of God. Paul says, you know what? I fill up two things over my lifetime. He says, two things I fill up. Wherever I go, I fill them up. I fill up preaching and I fill up suffering. I fill up preaching and I fill up suffering. You know, I don't know what God's called you specifically to do, but Paul knew what he was called to do. These two things. I mean, remember when he was first, it was announced to him by Ananias that he was going to be chosen of God to serve. And Ananias goes to him, and that's when the blind, you know, he was blind and he was made to see. And then Ananias says, you know, two things. God says you're going to talk to, you're going to take this message to the Gentiles, and then you're going to what? You're going to what? Suffer for my name's sake? Two things. You're going to preach to the Gentiles and suffer. All his life he did what? He preached and suffered, preached and suffered, preached and suffered. You want to tag any tag over Paul's name? He preached and he suffered. He preached and he suffered. He said, I understand. That's what God called me to do. I don't grumble about that or complain about that. I rejoice that I can do this. So is it surprising when he's at Ephesus, he says two things. He says a wide open door for ministry and what? Many adversaries. It's always how it is. Open door for preaching. Open door, you see, for people to get after me. And so Paul is at Ephesus and he says, I've got to stay for those two reasons. I don't want to leave Ephesus because God has a wide open door for ministry and God has much opposition. Did Paul anticipate what would happen? If you want to go to Acts sometime, we're not going to do it this morning. In Ephesus, it is the turning point of Paul's ministry because when he's there, that's what led him to go to Rome ultimately. When he's at Ephesus, all of a sudden Demetrius rises up and all of his people. Why? So many people were being saved that they stopped buying the idols that they were selling at the pagan temple, and pretty soon it was messing up business, so therefore they drove Paul out of town because it was messing up the economy. You know what? It's a nice thing if somehow the community begins to understand that we're here because of the change of the lives of people. That's what happened. And soon after, Paul writes this He didn't leave by choice. He's forced out of Ephesus. And so Paul says, this is where I determined to stay. But now notice what happens. He says, since I determined to stay here, notice something. This is what I plan to do. I take you back, if you will, to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. What I want to do, I shall come to you, verse 5, after I go through Macedonia, for I am going through Macedonia. Now, you know, it is fascinating here because here is Ephesus. Okay, by the way, just humor me for a while here. If you have your map in your mind, you see here is Asia Minor over here where Turkey is, right? Then across is where Greece is. And over here is Ephesus, is over the water here, right? So I can come straight across from Ephesus right across to Corinth. Actually, I'll probably land at Cenchrea. Corinth had three harbors, and it's a major place. So you can come from Ephesus right straight across by ship over here to this place at Corinth. So you come straight across, okay? But he says, no, I don't want to do that. And by the way, it's interesting, it's Pentecost because it means it's spring. Why is that important? Wintertime, you're not going to go across there too well, right? So what he says, instead of coming straight across, which I could do, I want to go up and around like this. So I'm going to go up here to Macedonia, then I'll travel down like this, down to see you. So this is what I plan to do. And by the way, the term he says, I want to pass through Macedonia, it's not as if he's just going to quickly go through. It's a term that's used when Paul went on trips like this where he just did these preaching expeditions, right? And remember, Macedonia, that's his major church, Philippi. I mean, those are the church that supported him over all those years and nobody else would. So Philippi's up there, Thessalonica's up there, Berea's up there. These are major churches, and he hasn't been back for a long time. So he says, I just want to pass through and see them, and perhaps... Notice this word perhaps, because he says, perhaps, he says, I shall stay with you or even spend the winter so that you might send me on my way wherever I may go. Do you know, it is interesting here because go with me, just turn a page to 2 Corinthians. He writes this, okay? He wrote this one, 1 Corinthians, the spring of the year. Later on in the fall, he is writing this 2 Corinthians just a few months later. Now notice what he says in verse 15 of 2 Corinthians chapter 1. In this confidence, I intended at first to come to you that you might twice receive a blessing. That is, to pass your way into Macedonia, again from Macedonia to come to you, and by you be helped on my way to Judea. Therefore, verse 17, I was not vacillating when I intended to do this, was I? Do you know why he had to write 2 Corinthians? Partly, these people got uptight. It is this very reference here. Paul says, I am planning to come and perhaps I can stay with you, right? He did go and stay there, by the way. It's where he wrote Romans from. It's where he wrote, I believe, Galatians from. He stayed there for a while. But you see, they got pushed out of shape because his plans weren't exactly as he thought they would be. And therefore, they said, you're lying. Paul says, I'm not lying, guys. It's amazing. So he has to write 2 Corinthians just to answer these people who are bothered because he said he would come and then he didn't. You see, this church is an amazing church. People are amazing people. You plan a church, you're trying to be open with people, you tell them this is what I'd like to do, and then I couldn't do it, and so therefore I wasn't lying to you. It's not like I say yes and I mean no, and I say no and I mean yes, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. He says, that's not my problem. But it's funny because this little reference in here is going to cause him to have to write a whole epistle just to answer these people a few months later because they were bothered because they said, you're lying to us. Paul says, perhaps. What I'd like to do, see, I'd like to go up through Macedonia. I'd like to come down. I'd like to spend the winter with you. How about it, okay? Now, notice he makes these plans, which he wasn't able to carry out fully, as he said, but he did come to see them, by the way. So this is what Paul planned to do. And I take you back, if you will, to chapter 16. He says, perhaps I shall stay with you or even spend the winter, that you may send me on my way wherever I may go. For I do not wish, verse 7 of chapter 16, to see you just in passing. For I hope to remain to you with you for some time, if the Lord permits. You know, don't miss that. Fact of the matter is, that is the key to everything you and I do, if the Lord permits. You see, I'd like to do this. Better add on to it if the Lord permits. Whether you say it verbally or you mean it in your own heart, it better be where you are, because you know what? Your life belongs to God. It doesn't belong to you. I'm intrigued with Paul. It isn't like, I mean, he has ideas of what he thinks he'd like to do, but he understands that they're all to be undermined by God's overall plan, right? That can change everything. Fact of the matter is, keep this in mind and go with me way back to James. Hebrews, James. If we're, I can help you if you've got the same Bible, but you probably don't, but anyhow. Page 353, but anyhow, James, Hebrews James. Notice this statement for all of us. It doesn't matter who in the world we are. Come now, verse 13 of James chapter 4. James 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow. And by the way, we don't have time to spend on this, but it's not as if one of these days, it's as if you set a specific day, okay, today or tomorrow. We shall go to a particular city, and we shall spend a particular amount of time there a year. We shall do a specific thing, engage in business. We shall make a specific kind of profit. Yet, you do not even know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, notice, if the Lord wills. Not only will we do this or that, if the Lord wills, where are you going to live tomorrow? And if the Lord wills, we'll do this. Or if the Lord wills, we'll do that. Notice the context of verse 17. It's in this context, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does it not, to him it is sin. You know what? Every one of us needs to take whatever plan that we have and submit it to the hand of God, because if you don't do it, it's sin. It's as simple as that. And so Paul says, understand, any plan I make is all to be submitted to the ultimate will of God. And if God wills it, I'll be there. If God doesn't will it, I won't show up. Now, with this in mind, look at then what he has to say to them. This is to a church that should be functioning the godly way. Now, verses 10 to 11. Now, I'm going to send Timothy, because I can't come. I'm back to 1 Corinthians 16. I can't come, so I'm sending Timothy. And if Timothy comes, why should you write this to a church? See that he is with you without cause to be afraid. Oh my goodness. Verse 11, let no one therefore despise him. Why? Why would a church cause someone to be afraid to come and do ministry among them? Well, that's what he's afraid will happen, and he isn't going to write this without cause. There's a cause. And his statement is, the reason why I don't want you to make this man to be afraid is because he's doing the Lord's work just like I also am. You know, it is an amazing thing, and we just do this in passing as we leave here, but just as fascinating that you have to write to a church and tell them, I'm sending somebody in my behalf, but don't cause him to be afraid and don't despise him. Now, Timothy, as you find out, was a little more faint-hearted kind of a guy, and he doesn't come with that boldness, okay? He had that problem. Paul has to tell him elsewhere, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. The guy just, you know, and he has to write to him, God has not given us a spirit of timidity, right? But Paul doesn't say, you know, he shouldn't be afraid. Paul says, don't you give him a cause to be afraid. Why should you have to write to a church and say, I'm going to send somebody, and just because you don't like him, you're going to take it out on him? I mean, just because you don't like me, you're going to take it out on him? That happens. Amazing, amazing. And so his guidelines to a godly church, he says, and this isn't a godly church, but it should be a godly church. He says, you know, these are my plans. Perhaps I'll come. If God lets me come, I'll come. But if I can't come, I'm going to send Timothy. All I'm asking you to do, please understand, he's in the ministry of God, just like I am. Make sure that he's not afraid when he comes, and make sure there's no reason that he should be. You know, it's interesting because it seems self-serving, but that's all right, I'm going to say it anyhow. I am amazed. To think back all the way to David and Saul. You know, when God has placed his hand on somebody for ministry, you hear it. I don't say much about people, other people in a negative way, especially other people in ministry. I tell you what, when God has placed his hand on somebody, be careful. Be careful. I mean, for David, He wouldn't even touch this man who was doing wrong because he says, you know what? I dare not touch God's anointed. And when a guy came back so gleeful, he says, I killed Saul. He says, you know what? We're going to kill you. Just an amazing thing. And so to this church, he gives a guideline. He says, guys, I got to tell you something. Treat this man in a godly way because he's in the ministry of God. Now I want to take you back to verses 1 to 4. And here it comes, this amazing thing. Guidelines, first of all, for a man of God. Guidelines for a church of God. Guidelines for the people of God. Verse 1 of chapter 16. Now concerning the collection for the saints. Now, first of all, you know what? There are a lot of words for giving, and this word collection is only used here in the New Testament. The same related word is used for taxation in other places, but it certainly isn't about taxation here. Do you know words that are used for giving? Blessing is used for giving. The word blessing is used for giving. You know what? When we talk about giving, we talk so much about money, and always in the Bible, this is the only place where there's anything that would be otherwise. Everywhere else, it's words like blessing, spiritual ministry. The word used more than the other is grace. In fact, the matter is, when he talks about here in this context, in verse 3, he says that I may carry your gift to Jerusalem. You know what the word is? I might carry your grace to Jerusalem. When Paul talks about money, he doesn't talk about money as money. He talks about money as ministry to people and ministry to God. It's a very fascinating thing. It's all about that. So words like blessing. Giving is a blessing. Giving is a grace. You have experienced God's grace. Now we have the chance of giving back, okay, an evidence of that grace. Giving is a act of service. The word deacon. Giving is called a deaconing, if you will. It's a matter of how in the world you and I in our life begin to bless God and bless other people. That's what giving's all about. How do I bless God? How do I bless others? You know, when you put money in an offering plate, and we're going to talk about that in a while. When you put money in the offering plate, you know what? You're not here to be giving, to be giving. You're here to be giving, to be blessing God and blessing others. That's what it's all about. And we can go through and we'll look at it when we get to 2 Corinthians. We'll see the terms that are used. But you know, this passage is not used at all. It's not here at all to try to get people to give. It's only some simple basic guidelines, but I hope we can learn something from them. So he says, first of all, I got to tell you about your collection for the saints. You know what? Do me a favor. If you have your bulletin or something, draw that triangle. See, I want you to draw the triangle. Do me a favor. Humor me. Find a space. Draw a triangle big enough so that you can do something with it. Draw the triangle, please. And when you draw this triangle, find the middle spot between the peak at the top and the bottom line, and draw a line across the middle of your triangle, and now you've got a little triangle at the top of the big triangle. Okay, are you with me? So draw a triangle, draw a line across the middle, straight across like this. Then divide the two halves you have, okay? Divide the half at the top, divide the half at the bottom. Now you've got four spots in there, okay? Do it for me. Humor me and go along. So we've got a triangle like this. We've got a line across the middle, another line. So we got three lines across like this, right? And we got four little spaces. Are you with me? Now just with me, okay? Do this. Go to the bottom of it and write principle in the bottom space. Biblical principle if you really want, but principle, all right? So the bottom space is principle. Everything is about principle, right? The next one up, write people, okay? The next space up, write people in it. Just watch this, okay? The next one up, write programs. And then that little wee triangle at the top. You can't even fit it in there. Write property. Property. Money, buildings, whatever, okay? Now just with me for a while. Look at that, okay? You know, when you look at this, Jesus' ministry is all about the bottom two. Nothing about the top. There's nothing about programs in his ministry. Nothing about property. All about principles. All about people. And understand, even when we look at a passage like this, what we're looking for is that bottom thing. We're trying to say, what is the biblical principle?
Let me tell you what the biblical principle is. You know when they were giving this money, it says the collection for the what? For the saints. Do you know what? Number one, there was no treasury. There was no church treasury. There were no church buildings. That's something. I mean, you go to Corinth and you excavate there, you're not going to find a huge church building. The church didn't need a lot of money to run. Are you with me? The basic biblical principle here is that the collection, the biblical principle at the bottom, is that the collection was not for the development of property in Jerusalem. Are you with me? The money was not for the development of programs in Jerusalem. The money was what? For the encouragement of the lives of what? People in Jerusalem. Do you know when they gave? They didn't give to programs. They didn't give for property. They gave for people. You know, I think about that because I think about a church. Pastor went in there and they built this huge building because they had to house the people who came, and there were a whole bunch of people came, and then because of morals, he had to leave. And some of the people were here 2 weeks ago, and I said, so how's it happening? Are they able to fill up once? They can't even fill up one service, let alone the three they had before. I went to Arizona to minister, and there was a church there where a former student of mine had gone, a very, very good pastor, and they built a huge facility, and he had the place packed out Saturday night, two services Sunday morning, and the elders get jealous because what happened is they could no longer control him because this thing was out of control, it was going and whatever, so they got rid of him, and now they've got a man in there, can't even fill it once, let alone three times, and all of a sudden you got a building. How many buildings have you seen that they're big, right? And so few people sitting inside of those buildings. And how long is this building going to last? You invest in people, it lasts for eternity. You invest in a building, it lasts for just a few years. Now, notice something else in here, and it's so contrary to what we like to do. Look at this passage. Okay, first of all, now it's for the collection for the saints. As I directed the church of Galatia, so also do you, on the first day of every week. Now, just something else while we're here. Do you realize that this is the first reference to an apostolic setting aside of a first day of the week? I mean, we're worshiping on the first day of the week. Literally, it's the first day from the Sabbath. By the way, some of you guys, it's an ablative. It's the first day away from the Sabbath. So anyhow, where it is, okay? First day from the Sabbath. Do you realize only three references in the whole New Testament to that kind of thing? It's called the Lord's Day in Revelation. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. It's the only reference we have to that. Acts 20, verse 7 is the only other reference. They were breaking bread on the Lord's Day, on the first day. So it was a day that seemed to be set aside. But if you think we have sparkling proof all over the Bible for the fact that we worship today and the people who own this building worship yesterday, right? We don't have a whole bunch of proof for that. Do you understand that, okay? That isn't the issue. But there was something about this first day of the week that he says, I want you to set this money aside. But what we know is interesting is I looked at this, I found it very fascinating because as a preacher, it's one of those things you get up there and say, you know, you ought to bring your money to the church every first day of the week and give it to God for what? For our building, see? So number one, it wasn't for a building. And number two, they weren't even supposed to bring it to the church. I'm serious. Look at this. On the first day of every week. And why the first day? You know what? We'll talk about this. Let each one of you, this is everybody, and you know there were slaves in this church. Put the money aside. I like this, just put aside and save it or whatever you will, but put aside treasuring it, if you will. In other words, actually, you know what it says? It says, by yourself, set this money aside. It didn't say, bring it to the church. You say, Pastor, hold it, we got to pay the bills. Listen to me, it's not what it says. It doesn't say bring the money to the church. Yeah? It says take this money on the first day of the week. Sit down on the first day of every week. You got to do it. And then it says, you know what? Whatever you have been prospered. Someone says, boy, I got a problem with that one. So they say, he couldn't mean that whatever God prospers you with, give it. But he says, you know what you ought to do every first day of every week? Not just every week. He says, every first day. There's something about Sunday, see? Sit down and look back over the past week and see how God has prospered you. There's no 10% here. I mean, for some of us, we give 10%, and what we have left over is an amazing amount of money. You know, R.G. Letourneau, what? He started out, he got challenged to give 10%. By the time he got through, he's given 90% of all he made to God. Then there's some of these people who are giving what they have to God, but then they want to control it when they give it. We're sitting in a meeting one day, and we say, you know what, maybe we ought to sell this building, because what are we sitting here looking at this building for? And some guy says, ah, you got to check with the guy who gave it for you can do that. And I thought, aha, you gave it? Yeah, figured. You know, it's amazing, letting go of what you give and understand, you know what? But it's interesting, he says, you know, look at every week, sit down and say, how did I prosper this last week? Because what all of a sudden happens, you get more back, you come back from doing your income tax and say, whoo, that's a great amount we're getting back. Let's go buy that boat. Are you with me? Isn't that what you think? No, you don't think that. You're more spiritual, not more eschatological, but some of us think that way, see? I can finally buy the camper, see? No. Sit down at the beginning of every week and look back over how God has prospered you. Okay? And then he says, set aside for yourself. For yourself. Set aside. Listen to this. Let me read. I love these quotations, and that's why I will read this. This is some good stuff. Listen to this. The statement is, Chrysostom, by the way, said, you know, the reason they did is because the slaves brought their money and put in the offering plate. It looked like so small compared to everybody else's. So you see, they would do it this way so that it didn't become so obvious. It's fascinating. Someone says, be a guardian of holy possessions, a self-elected steward of the poor. Boy, think about that. A self-elected steward of the poor. See, it's dangerous for me to teach this stuff because you say, all right, I am the guardian of the money. Absolutely you are under God. Do you understand that? And every week you stop and look and say, God, how do we do this week? All right, God. And by the way, it is in a sense, you know, well, I give God his token every month and this is fine. See, how has God prospered you? Then give accordingly. There's no percentage here. Just give. But don't give it to the church here. You're setting it aside for the sake of ministering to people. And you say, well, the church has become that vehicle. Yes, it has. But you see, it is a personal thing. And it's so interesting because all of a sudden, and I just think back to times when we set up these major programs, and then we're out there trying to hound the people, and then we're worrying about ways that maybe they're sinning by not giving. You know what? Can we not trust the Holy Spirit to work in each of our hearts to convict us of those things so that we will begin to do that which God has enabled us to do? Huh? Why does the church have to create the program, then hound the people to do this, when are we not Spirit-filled people who can understand what it's like to take what God has prospered us with and set it aside and put it there so that we'll be able, we become the self-elected stewards of the poor. I love that. You say, Pastor, it doesn't help your business out. It doesn't worry about my business. See, it's not my church anyhow. Do you understand that, see? What an amazing passage. And I'm going to come in a while, he says, to collect this money. All I'm trying to do, I'm not trying to get you to give. I'm not trying to incite you to give. When I come, I don't want an offering to be taken. Please, don't take an offering when I get there. Sit down and let God work in your heart. Let God take that amount as you look every week. And it would be good for us to do that. God, what'd you do this week? Oh, my. Listen, God, I would love to set this aside to minister to people. And you begin to watch the ministry happen as each of us begins to understand that's what this God-ordained work of the Spirit is in the lives of each one of us. And you know what? If we really are eschatological people, what we're going to do with that profit every week is going to be so different than if we're not. If we're earthbound, we're going to buy all kinds of gadgets and toys and stuff, right? If we're heavenly bound, understand the only way to invest in eternity is to invest now. You can't take it with you. You got to invest right now. And if you don't invest now, it won't be there when you get there. Just understand that's how it is. amazing things as you walk through here and look at this passage. And may God help us all somehow to understand. All of this is rooted on the fact that we shall be raised again. And because of the eschatological nature of our lives and our hope, somehow should transform the way we are down here. As godly men, making sure that we're not fighting for ourselves, we understand it is the church of God. As a church of God, understand that we need to treat each other in a godly, loving fashion. Understand that we do not cause fear in the hearts of people. Understand that as a people of God, it isn't the pressure of people forcing us to give or encouraging us to give or making us to give. It is our hearts before God saying, this is a blessing, this is a grace, this is a service. And I have become, I love this, self-elected steward to the poor. Is it not great? God can use us individually to touch the lives of people in such an incredible way. May God help us. May God help us to become those kinds of people that are transformed by God to be different than we ever were before. Shall we pray? Again, our Father, we're grateful to you. We look at this passage so easy to walk through it and walk out the other side and fail to see the significance of these truths. Help us to be those who look beyond this life, to understand the impact, though, of our future hope on everything we do here and now. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
We conclude our worship by again singing in song, affirming the facts that indeed are our hope and our reason for why we serve and why we live in glory in our Lord and Savior, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Would you please stand as we sing?
Receive them.